Hey there, and welcome to the Restoration Living Podcast. My name is James Johnson, and I am excited that you have chosen to spend time with us today. The goal of this podcast is to show that God's heart for each of us is to come back home to Him in order for us to experience a restoration of peace, joy, and growth in our lives. We do this by digging deep into God's Word in order to find timeless truths that we can apply in our lives today. So let's get out our Bibles and take another step down this path of restoration living together. Welcome back to the Restoration Living Podcast. And man, I owe you guys an apology. I got my notes mixed up because I've been doing two sets of series. We've been working on our cult versus cultic series we just started, but also continuing through our journey through the book of Revelation. We've been doing two at the same time, and so that was probably a little more than I should have been doing. And as a result, I got my notes mixed up, and we skipped right from the middle of chapter 16, all the way to the middle of chapter 18. We skipped like a chapter to two chapters. So if you've already listened to our last episode on Revelation chapter 18, we're going to backtrack some. And if this is, you know, something you don't want to mess with, I apologize. You can just wait for the next one when we catch up. But we need to cover this part because this is really important. Where we left off last time, we had completed the end of two episodes ago. So we're going to catch up to the last one we did in Revelation chapter 18. So let's go back to Revelation chapter 16 when we left off at chapter 16, verse 17. We heard the exclamation that John records for us when he, you know, hears the in verse 17, the echoing of what Jesus said on the cross of "It is finished." He heard the mighty shout come from the throne in the temple in heaven. And of course, who sits on the temple in heaven, on the throne in the temple in heaven? God does. And of course, Jesus is God. So this is an echoing that we are hearing of the work that was done on the cross. And what the text is showing us here is that the work Jesus did on the cross is the completion of getting rid of the old covenant. The old covenant no longer exists, and so now we're under the new covenant. Why does that matter? Because like we've discussed multiple times before, the old covenant, the law of Moses, was a guardian. The Apostle Paul uses that language to say it was like a guardian who was waiting for us to mature to receive our inheritance. The inheritance from God is a reconnection to Him through forgiveness, justification, and restoration that happens under the new covenant. And if you want more information on this, go back in the episodes and find the ones where we talk about the Easter episode where we talked about God's great love story. That the mystery that God kept secret until the time of the early church was that His plan was not just for a single nation to be brought back to God. It was that everybody who wants to come back to God can come home. Remember earlier when John heard that there would be 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, or 144,000 total, that would come into the kingdom from Israel. That was what he heard. But what he saw was countless millions from every tongue, tribe, and nation in the world. That is the goal of the new covenant. The old covenant, according to many passages in the Bible, but specifically the book of Hebrews, tells us the old covenant has become obsolete. And we finished the last part where we left off with Revelation chapter 16 by looking at the promise that Paul gave us in his letter to the church in Rome, saying that now that everybody can be made right with God through what Jesus Christ did on the cross, where He freed us from the penalty of our sin. So that was where we left off in Revelation 16, verse 17. We're going to backtrack. So once again, forgive me for getting confused. Let's backtrack to Revelation chapter 16 and verse 18. So what we have seen, just a very quick recap, is each of the three sets of seven does away with part of the promise of the Mosaic Covenant. The first set of seven, referred to the seven seals, refers to the promised land. The second set of seven, the seven trumpets, refers to the unity of the nation of Israel. And the third sets of seven, the bowl judgments, refers to the sacrificial system. All three of those things have been done away with. There's no longer a need for the promised land because now the whole world is where God's people can occupy, because that was the goal in the beginning of creation anyway. There's no longer a need for the unity of one single nation for God's chosen people, because now everybody in the entire world, Jew and Gentile alike, can now be brought back to God's family. And there's no longer a need for a sacrificial system, because what good would it do? We don't need to offer sacrifices anymore. And some of you have heard me tell this before, but when I was doing my master's degree, I was doing my Master of Divinity, I had to take a class on Old Testament. It actually took multiple classes, but in one of them, when we were talking about the book of Ezekiel and the promise of Ezekiel's temple, I got in trouble because the paper I wrote, my thesis was, there's no need for another temple, a third temple, because of what Jesus has done, and that the sacrificial system is over because there's no longer a need for sacrifices. Jesus was the perfect sacrifice, and so there's no need for that temple, and that my thesis was that that was the temple that the Israelites were supposed to rebuild after returning from exile to Babylon and Medo-Persia. But they squandered the resources Cyrus the Great gave them on their own homes, and so Ezekiel's temple could not be built, and the second temple was what would eventually become Herod's temple, did not follow the pattern in the book of Ezekiel. But when my professor wrote me a paper back to criticize my paper and telling me how the third temple is going to be symbolic, that it's Ezekiel's temple is going to be built and the priests are going to offer sacrifice as a symbol of the representation of the sacrificial system. And I didn't make a fuss about it because you never want to fight your teachers. But I thought to myself, how ludicrous. Why in the world would we need to offer sacrifices? And like we talked about last time, who would offer them? If we did rebuild the temple, who's going to be the priests? Who are going to be the priests? One of the things that is also important to recognize is after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the genealogies were destroyed. So there can be no king of Israel. I mean, all these things are done away with. There is only one king, and his name is Jesus. He's our high priest. And there's no longer a need for a temple because the temple in heaven is where Jesus is. And what we're going to see eventually is in the new heaven and the new earth, there is no temple. And we're going to talk more about that when we get there. So those three sets of seven are now over. Now we're going to see, now that the promised land, the unity of the nation of Israel, and the sacrificial system have been done away with, we're going to see what happens next in the promise that John is giving, that God has given John to give to the church at that time. So let's see what happens next. So by now, hopefully you're in Revelation 16. Let's look at verse 18. Then the thunder crashed and rolled, and lightning flashed, and a great earthquake struck, the worst since people were placed on the earth. The great city of Babylon split into three sections, and the cities of many nations fell into heaps of rubble. So God remembered all of Babylon's sins and made her drink the cup that was filled with the wine of his fierce wrath. Now, let's not lose our mindset here. Apocalyptic literature is a genre of literature that uses fantastic imagery as symbols to represent earthly realities. We know that this is not a literal thing that's meant to be taken as a massive earthquake. What do earthquakes represent? What's the symbol here? It's a massive shaking up. It's saying this is the biggest earthquake the world has ever seen. This is the biggest shaking up of world powers that we're talking about. Earthquakes represent the shaking up of the ground and the earth. Each of these is a symbol. If this was a real earthquake, we would have seen all these natural disasters. But what is being shown here is that this is a shaking up of the world. Up until this point, a Jewish person would have felt that the Roman Empire encompassed all of the known world. We've talked about that, you know, forever. We beat that horse dead. So what we see is this represents the breaking of Babylon, which is Rome, into three sections. What does that mean? Well, we see in history, because we've got the privilege of history being on our side, we can look back and see what happened. There were three massive rebellions that happened in the Roman Empire. First was, you know, after Nero's death, there was one in 69 AD, another one in 81 AD, and another one in 99 AD. Now, if we look at that option as an interpretation, well, it takes 20 years. It's possible, but there's another more favorable option. After Nero's death, there were actually three successive emperors who were nominated. We've talked about this before. This is known as the Year of the Four Emperors. This, I believe, is a better interpretation of what this passage is talking about. Rather than the three big rebellions, that's a possible, but this is much more likely because earthquakes happen quickly. And I think if we're using the imagery, the symbolism of an earthquake, we would look to an event that happened quickly that upset the balance of the whole world and broke Rome into three different chunks. And this we would see that after Nero would be the emperor Caesar Galba. Galba would go, leave, and he would go into, when he died, Otho would take his place. Otho would be replaced by Vitellius, and Vitellius would be replaced by Vespasian. Now, to become the emperor, you had to have the loyalty of the people, the loyalty of the military, and the loyalty of the Roman Senate. Each of these leaders gained and lost their favor, and if you were a citizen in Rome, could you imagine what this would have felt like to have three separate emperors or four separate emperors come in one year? This would be incredibly, you know, powerful. It would be like an earthquake. That's why this is being used as a symbol, I believe. I think this is the better interpretation of this. And it's important because God also works through these rebellions and the shaking up of the leadership of Rome to begin punishing Rome. We are shifting our focus away from the Jewish people because everything has been taken from them. The Mosaic Covenant is over, and now the church has replaced Israel as God's people. The scripture tells us that true Israel is now the church. And so what does God do? God brings judgment on Israel for failing to keep the law of Moses and failing to recognize Jesus as their Messiah. But now the punishment is going to overflow to the Romans. And in this situation, we bring all of these rebellions, all of these destructions, so much death, famine, disease, and war on the people of Rome. This is finishing the seventh bowl judgment. And out of that is now coming a judgment on Rome, not just Israel. Look at what happens next. There was the massive earthquake. Look at verse 20. And every island disappeared, and all the mountains were leveled. There was a terrible hailstorm, and hailstones weighing as much as 75 pounds fell from the sky onto the people below. They cursed God because of the terrible plague of the hailstorm. It's tempting, like I said before, to take this literally. But this did not happen. It would be impossible. I mean, what would have to happen to the planet Earth for all the mountains to be leveled and every island to disappear? That would be impossible. And people survive. And so we know these are symbols. This is saying that these earthly changes are so drastic and dramatic that it's like these things happened. A terrible hailstorm, hailstones weighing as much as 75 pounds. Guys, if hailstones that weighed 75 pounds began to hit the earth, it would destroy so many things. Life would, it would be like getting hit by so many asteroids. And it would say that people cursed God because of the terrible plague of the hailstorm. Now, what we can start seeing clues here is it's a plague. Where have we seen plagues happen before in the Bible? Well, in the Exodus. So we see this is a mirroring of the different plagues, and it's not going to go in order. We're going to discuss it as we go, but this is a parallel. You see, what God is doing here is the same thing he did in the Exodus. He wanted to show Pharaoh and the Egyptians that Yahweh was not just one of many gods. He was the one true God. He was the all-powerful, greatest Elohim, the creator of all the other earthly and heavenly beings. And each of the plagues that God brought on the Egyptians in Exodus were meant to show his superiority to the Egyptian gods. Well, this is what we're going to start seeing here in the section to show that God is more superior than the pagan Roman gods. And just as the people of Egypt failed to recognize this and began to turn their hearts away from their pagan gods to worship Yahweh, in the Exodus, it actually tells us that Pharaoh and the people hardened their hearts against Yahweh and cursed him for the plagues. This is what's going to happen, that none of the leaders during this time frame are going to turn to Yahweh. They're actually going to turn back to the pagan gods, and the people, like we just saw, are going to curse Yahweh and persecute the church as a result of it. So what we the first bowl judgment was poured out on the earth. The goddess Tellus or Terra was the pagan deity who controlled all of the earth. She was considered this idea of Mother Earth, this Gaia idea. Her consort, her lover, was Ceres, who was the god connected with grain and harvest. What happens in the second bowl? It was poured out on the sea. This would go against the Roman god Neptune. Neptune was in charge of all of the oceans and fresh water. And so all of these plagues we've seen from the earlier judgments were plagues against these gods. What happens in the third bowl judgment is poured on the rivers and springs. This could be Neptune, but it could also be connected to lesser deities, the nymphs and the sprites that controlled the different rivers. And so one of the things that we see is these bowl judgments are showing us as this judgment against the pagan gods, the same way the plagues in Exodus were against the Egyptian gods. The fourth bowl judgment poured out on the sun and caused darkness. This would be against the Roman god Sol. Sol is where we get the idea of the sun worship. And so as Jesus God is pouring these bowl judgments out, God is in charge of the darkness, not Sol. The fifth bowl was on the throne of the beast, the city of Rome. Jupiter was the patron god of Rome. And the darkness would show, man, Jupiter, you are not in control. You can't even protect your city, Rome, against Yahweh. And it was the civil war and all these things. The sixth bowl judgment on the Euphrates River. The Euphrates River was connected to this idea of man, the Euphrates River was where so many pagan gods in the past were connected to, and the god actually was called Euphrates. And the Romans worshiped the god Euphrates as well, as the history of, you know, that tied it from pagan worship into the past to the pagan worship of Rome. And the final one was poured out on the air. And these were the four venti that were known as the gods of the air. Each one controlled a different wind. And God is saying, hey, you four gods, you're not in charge of the wind. I'm in control of it. I'm pouring my judgment out on the air. You see, all of the things that Rome hypocritically believed they had in their safety and their wealth, God is saying, mm-mm. The same way I showed Egypt that I was the one that was really in control, now I'm showing you, Rome, that I'm really in control. Bowl one, poured out on the earth against Tellus. Bowl 2, poured out on the sea against Neptune. Bowl 3, poured out on the rivers and springs against the god Fontus. Bowl 4, poured out on the sun against the god Sol. Bowl 5, poured out on the throne of the beast against Jupiter, the patron of the city of Rome. Bowl 7, poured out on the Euphrates River against the god Euphrates. And Bowl 7, poured into the air against the venti four gods. You see how this works? When we see the context, we don't have to imagine and try and draw, pie in the sky by and by figures here. We understand the connection because we understand the Old Testament. Now, how does the next section of the book of Revelation unfold? Now that the three cycles of seven are over and judgment has come on Rome, now we're going to see how God is going to destroy the beast and the dragon and the false prophet. All of these things are going to be done away with because of what they have done to God's people, the church. So let's jump into Revelation chapter 17. The three sets of seven are over. Now Rome is receiving its judgment. And how is God going to destroy the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet? Let's look at that together. Verse 1 of chapter 17. One of the seven angels who had poured out the seven bowls came over and spoke to me. Come with me, he said, and I will show you the judgment that is going to come on the great prostitute who rules over many waters. The kings of this world have committed adultery with her, and the people who belong to this world have been made drunk by the wine of her immorality. Now, we've talked about this before, but this is obviously the city of Rome. The great prostitute. Rome prostituted herself out to all these other nations to get them to come in and buy and sell and trade within her to make everyone wealthy and to have these earthly pleasures. Well, we see everything from food, language, music, entertainment, religion. All of this came from Rome as it pushed its culture out to the other nations it conquered. And not only did they push their culture, they began to absorb and alter other cultures. We saw this even with the Jewish culture. In order to make peace with the Romans after the revolts, they said, fine, we will take on your worship. And the synagogues actually worship not only Yahweh, but other pagan gods as well. If you go to some of these ancient Roman Jewish synagogues, you can find altars to Yahweh, but also altars to other pagan gods. So this is the great prostitute is Rome. Look at verse 3. The angel took me in the spirit into the wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that had seven heads, 10 horns, and blasphemies against God were written all over it. The woman wore purple and scarlet clothing and beautiful jewelry made of gold and precious gems and pearls. In her hand, she held a goblet full of obscenities and impurities of her immorality. Now, it's interesting that the angel takes John into the wilderness, the desert. The desert is where Israel was forced to wander for 40 years as a result of their failure to trust God. The desert is where Jesus went for 40 days and nights to be tempted by Satan. It's fitting John would show the great prostitute going into the wilderness as the temptation to the people Israel. The woman is riding on a beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. This is a connection to the first beast we saw come out of the sea. This beast the great prostitute is riding on is the Roman Empire itself. As Rome conquered more and more territories and led them into the adultery of pagan worship, instead of worshiping the one true God, it corrupted them. We see this in the way the great prostitute is betrayed, wearing the finest clothes, the finest jewels, getting drunk, and from all of these things, from a cup that is filled with things that displease God. The great prostitute is Rome itself. Not just the city, but the values of Rome. This pagan culture, this Hellenized culture that inserted itself into every nation it conquered. Like Babylon, Rome uprooted the values of its nation and forced it on the nations it conquered. They were forced to speak the Roman language, Koine Greek. They were forced to use Rome's money, the denarius, and they were forced to worship Rome's gods unless they could prove, like the Jewish nation, that they had an older form of worship, and many of them couldn't do that. And of course, everyone during this time began to be forced to worship the emperor and the different emperors that had, starting with Nero on, the Caesars would begin to want to be worshipped while they were alive as God, as a God. Look at verse 5. A mysterious name was written on her forehead, Babylon the Great, mother of all prostitutes and obscenities in the world. I could see that she was drunk with the blood of God's holy people who were witnesses for Jesus. I stared at her in complete amazement. Look at what John's imagery is showing us, that she has a name on her forehead, Babylon. What would Babylon represent to a Jewish person? Captivity. The conquering people who destroyed Jerusalem, conquered their nation, and took them off into slavery, deported them and spread them all over the world. This would be an obvious connection for a Jewish person to say, wow, they are connecting Babylon and Rome together. Now remember, John can't write that this is about Rome. Under the hypothesis that this is a letter that needed to be sent to the churches that would have been read by John's guards, if it spoke badly about Rome expressly, then it never would have made it out. So John needs to camouflage this idea, and he uses the symbology of Babylon to do that. And it says that the great prostitute, the name of the great prostitute is Mysterious. It says a mysterious name was written on her forehead. A mystery means it's something we need to solve, a puzzle we need to figure out. And we've already done that. We figured out that this puzzle is Babylon because it is that Babylon is Rome because of the similarities between those two empires. And she's also called the mother of all prostitutes and obscenities in the world. What would a Jewish person, a person in the church that during that time say, what's the epicenter of all this evil in the world? Well, it would obviously be the city of Rome. And so John is making this connection. It says that the great prostitute is drunk from the obscenities and impurities in the goblet that she carried. John is giving us greater detail to say this is the blood of the martyrs, those who were persecuted and killed for being followers of Jesus, the blood of God's holy people who were witnesses for Jesus. The word witness there is the Greek word martyr. These are people, and a martyr is in the time before it became known as somebody who gave their life for their faith, for their cause. It was a court witness, an eyewitness to a crime. And so this is what the idea of martyrs were, witnesses to their faith in Jesus, that they believed so strongly in their trust in Jesus that they were willing to die for them, and the prostitute is drunk from their blood. John is letting us know another clue. Who was, causing the blood of the Christians to flow? Well, it was Rome. And it was terrible. It was an obscenity to have that happen, that to have God's people be killed for their faith. Look at verse 7. Why are you so amazed? The angel asked. I will tell you the mystery of this woman and of the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns on which she sits. The beast you saw was once alive, but isn't now. And yet he will soon come out of the bottomless pit and go to eternal destruction. And the people who belong to this world, whose names were not written in the book of life before the world was made, will be amazed at the reappearance of this beast who died. Now, that doesn't sound like a very powerful explanation, does it? So the angel is telling more details. Well, what are the details letting us know? That it was the woman and the beast that are connected to the one that was once alive, that isn't now, but has come back. See, after the death of Nero and all the rebellions and all of the year of the four emperors, if you were an average Roman, you probably were afraid that the Roman Empire was about to fall. You were probably afraid that, like empires in the past, they were going to become so weak they were taken over. And it looked like everything was over for the Roman Empire. But what happened? It came back from the dead. It resurrected under new leadership and new rule. And we see that as we look at history. Now, what beast was contained in the bottomless pit? Well, this would be all of the rebellious angels that were held there. The bottomless pit was known as where Tartarus was. And there's this connection that just as the Romans believed that the Titans were imprisoned in Tartarus, the Jews carried that connection of that word Tartarus over. We see this in the book of Jude, that this is where the angels who rebelled in the beginning of the world and came down and had children with human beings and created the Nephilim. Their punishment was to live in darkness. And so as we look at this, we may be tempted to call this hell, but there's a cultural context this bottomless pit has. And so what does this symbolize? We're seeing all of this evil, that the same evil that experienced when the world began, where people rebelled against God, now we're seeing more of it, and the Roman Empire is leading it. And what we see in verse 9 is even more clues. It says, this calls for a mind with understanding. The 7 heads of the 7 beasts represent the 7 hills where the woman rules. They also represent 7 kings. 5 have already fallen. The 6th now reigns, and the 7th is yet to come, but his reign will be brief. Now, John is giving us clues. What city exists on 7 hills that this could possibly be? Well, Rome is known as the City of 7 Hills. That's actually its name. So everybody would have connected that. If you were to count the number of emperors from the beginning, counting as Augustus, Caesar Augustus as the first one, then Nero would be the 6th one to rule. It was his name. After Nero, that's what it says. It says five have already fallen. The sixth now reigns. At the time that John wrote this, Nero is the emperor. And so, well, who comes next? Galba would rule, and then we'd have the great upheaval in the year of the four emperors we've already talked about. So as we close our time in this session, what we're seeing is the sevens are done. The three sets of seven are done. The focus is no longer on Israel. Now it's on Rome, as God is telling his people how he is going to bring punishment and destroy the beast, Rome, the dragon, Satan, and the false prophet, this false system of religion that was created. And now we know who these images represent. So when we come back next time, we can look at that. We can talk about how God is doing this. So we know that's the plan. The bowl judgments are over, just as they were meant to set the Israelites free from their captivity. Now the church is going to be set free. And just as the Babylonian Empire had punishment brought on it for what it did to Israel, now Rome is going to have its punishment. So until next time, hey, join us. We're going to keep going through this. And next time, man, we're going to dig deeper. So until then, be blessed. Thank you for joining us for this episode. We pray that God uses it to inform your mind, improve your life, and ignite your heart with a renewed passion to impact others for the kingdom of God. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast so that you can continue along with us on this journey of restoration living.